This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, August 1st, 2013. In Kansas City, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up, in Washington, lawmakers confirm a new head for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms after 6 years. We go to Turkey, where a massive dam project threatens to flood an ancient city on the banks of the Tigris River. And in the Philippines, environmentalists win a court battle to halt research on genetically modified eggplant. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Today, Edward Snowden left the Moscow airport a free man. Russia granted the accused NSA leaker 1 year of asylum, according to WikiLeaks, which is assisting Snowden. Snowden issued a statement through the whistleblower organization thanking Russia, saying, quote, "Over the past 8 weeks, we have seen the Obama administration show no respect for international or domestic law, but in the end, the law is winning." White House spokesperson Jay Carney said the administration was extremely disappointed in Russia's decision.
"This move by the Russian government undermines a longstanding record of law enforcement cooperation, cooperation that has recently been on the upswing since the Boston Marathon bombings."
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham was less guarded with his language. He said the administration should be firm.
"I think we should hit him back and hit him hard."
The U.S. maintains that Snowden is not a whistleblower. Carney said the White House is evaluating whether the president will now attend an upcoming summit in Russia. Snowden has been in the international transit area of the Moscow airport for more than a month, awaiting decisions on 20 asylum requests to different countries. His current location is unknown. The American Civil Liberties Union and Lambda Legal filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of two couples today, challenging the constitutionality of the state of Virginia's ban on same-sex marriage. In the suit filed in a Virginia district court, they allege that denying marriage rights to gays and lesbians creates second-class citizens. Amanda Goad is an attorney with the ACLU.
"But we also filed today's case as a class action. That means we will be seeking to represent not only the two couples named on the legal papers, but all same-sex couples who wish to marry in Virginia, as well as all the same-sex couples calling Virginia home who are validly married in other jurisdictions, but currently do not have those marriages respected by their home state."
Although the Supreme Court overturned the section of DOMA denying federal recognition of same-sex marriage, the provision allowing states not to recognize out-of-state licenses still stands. Both Maryland and Washington, D.C. allow the practice, meaning the difference between full marriage rights and virtually no legal recognition at all could be just a few miles away for Virginia couples. Today in Zimbabwe, the party of presidential candidate Morgan Tsvangirai declared the result of Wednesday's election null and void, citing irregularities in the electoral process. Despite this, vote counts are continuing, and early indications place incumbent Robert Mugabe as the winner. FSRN's Gerikai Chanzo reports from the capital.
Prime Minister Tsvangirai told reporters today that the election results had been compromised. He cited cases of intimidation and registered voters being turned away from the polls. These protests were begged by the Zimbabwe Election Support Network, which was monitoring the polls. Reverend Solomon Zwana is the board chair.
"Based on the empirical reports from our observers, the credibility of the 2013 harmonized elections is seriously compromised by a systematic effort to disenfranchise urban voters up to 1 million.
But those claims were disputed by the 25-member observer team from the Southern Africa Development Community. Advocate Notemba Tipwenja endorsed the election. Vote counting is in progress, with official results expected in 5 days. Gerikai Chaonza, FSRN, Harare.
A decision earlier this week to create a new state in India has prompted a second day of demonstrations in Andhra Pradesh, the state slated to be divided. Nearly a dozen lawmakers from the ruling Congress party have tendered their resignations in protest. But some organizations are seeing the creation of Telangana state as a ray of hope in their own fight for more local control. FSRN's Prabhakar Mani Tiwari reports.
One youth is dead today after being shot by police during a protest in Assam. There, at least 9 organizations are holding demonstrations calling for a separate state called Bodoland for the ethnic Bodo people. Protesters burned several government offices. The All Bodo Students Union has threatened a 12-hour railway blockade tomorrow, and additional strikes are planned next week. Agitators in the neighboring Darjeeling Hills of West Bengal are wrapping up a 72-hour bandh today and have called for another strike beginning Saturday. The Gorkha people have been pushing for the creation of Gorkhaland state for decades. West Bengal's chief minister said Wednesday that a division of the current state is out of the question. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari, FSRN, Kolkata.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in Kansas City. In Washington, a Republican filibuster nearly derailed the confirmation of the director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, which has been leaderless since 2006. The Senate approved Todd Jones to head the agency with the bare minimum number of votes, after waiting 5 hours for a lawmaker to fly back from her home state and break the stalemate. With the agency soon to be equipped with a permanent full-time leader, lawmakers and gun safety advocates gathered on Capitol Hill to call for the passage of new gun control measures and better enforcement of those already on the books. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
It took all afternoon Wednesday for senators to muster the 60 votes needed to overcome a filibuster on Todd Jones' nomination to lead the agency tasked with enforcing the nation's alcohol, cigarette, and gun laws. During the standoff on a largely party-line vote, senators convinced Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski to switch her no vote to a yes. Murkowski told FSRN Thursday why she decided to support the confirmation.
It was a position that needed to be filled. We know it's been hanging out there for a long time. And Mr. Jones has been acting for a long time, but we also recognize that he's been dealing with two different jobs. That's hard for anybody.
Jones will now leave his part-time job as the U.S. Attorney for Minnesota to be the Bureau's first full-time director since 2006. Democratic Representative Robin Kelly, a member of Congress's Gun Violence Prevention Task Force, told FSRN she's hopeful for stronger action on gun control from the agency in the months ahead.
I represent 33% of Chicago, and a couple of my wards have been heavily impacted, you know, by gun violence, youth violence, and game violence, and I want to see universal background checks. I want to see trafficking laws, store purchasing laws stronger federally, and whatever we can do in the state to do that, because we're losing a generation of young people, which is, you know, terrible, and people are in fear.
The Bureau is supposed to propose and enforce regulations on where, how, and what type of guns are sold. But Congress has passed a number of bills over the past few decades to strip away the agency's power, such as a ban on their maintaining a database of gun transactions, another ban on agents conducting more than one unannounced inspection of a gun dealer per year, and deep cuts to its budget. The Senate then filibustered every nominated director since 2006, leaving the agency to cycle through five acting directors in that time. President Obama nominated Jones after the mass shooting of children and teachers at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut.
It's about having a strong head of an agency to say, here's what we're seeing, here's the data we have, and here's how we can act.
That's stay-at-home mom-turned-gun safety activist Shannon Watts, who traveled to Washington from Indianapolis this week to demand that Congress and the newly staffed Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms get to work on regulating the gun industry. Watts' organization, Moms Demand Action, planned to target members of Congress in their home districts during the August recess that begins tomorrow. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
As Apple employees in the U.S. launch a class action lawsuit against the company for unpaid wages and labor violations here, a new report released this week sheds light on the labor conditions at Apple's suppliers in China. China Labor Watch found that the U.S. company is violating the law and its own pledges about working conditions. CLW sent investigators into three Pegatron Group factories to carry out undercover investigations and found 86 labor rights violations, including excessive working hours and poor working conditions. Kevin Slayton is program coordinator for China Labor Watch in New York. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
How exactly did your investigators conduct these interviews?
Our investigators went in undercover. They went in as workers. So they would apply just like any other workers would and go through the interview and the health check and all that, and then go in and live in the factory and work with the workers there. Then we also had investigators go outside of the factories to confirm the results that our undercover investigators found inside the factories. They would do outside of the factory, they would do external interviews.
Your report says these three Pegatron factories, two in Shanghai and one in Suzhou, together they employ 70,000 people. In one of these Pegatron factories in Shanghai, employees work 11-hour shifts, 6 days a week, and earn less than half the local monthly income of, you say, $764. Tell us more about the wages these workers earn and how Apple itself is in violation of labor laws here.
With the wages, they aren't necessarily... The minimum wage isn't necessarily a legal violation. We argue that this is an ethical one. So we say there's illegal and ethical violations. The legal violation that sort of comes out of this is that workers are just doing minimum wage in a very expensive city, and that forces them to really to rely on overtime. So they're given a lot of overtime, and they have no choice to do it anyway, but they need that overtime. And so they're doing 100, 120, 130 hours of overtime a month in order to make a living wage, not a high wage, but a living wage in Shanghai. And the hours they do are illegal. So if you're doing 120 hours of overtime a month, you're not supposed to do, as a worker, you're not supposed to be made to do 36 hours of overtime a month. So this is, the factory is organizing these sorts of hours, and that's something that we think Apple and Pegatron need to take responsibility for.
Students seem to be particularly exploited. Can you tell us a bit about their working conditions?
Students at these factories who are sometimes underage workers, and underage in China is 16 or 17 years old, they are working just like adults. They go into the factory and do these long hours and are standing for many of these hours. We found the one student during the course of the investigation that was education major, and she was in there and she said it had nothing to do with what she was studying. But these students are often required by their vocational schools to do this sort of internship, or else they can't graduate. It's for credit, and so it's really compulsory for them.
These many thousands of workers are accommodated near the factories. Can you tell us a little bit more about how they live and where they're accommodated?
Many of them live in dormitories that are run by or in the factory campus, and the dormitories have 8 to 12 people per room. The three factories that we looked at had very crowded dorms. Number of shower heads for like one level, there'd be 120 workers or hundreds of workers on a level of a dorm, and there'd only be 10, 12, 20 shower heads. After these long days, they would line up then for a shower, and the showers were always cold. These are things that would very quickly be improved.
Your report mentions a whopping 86 violations in total, but when your investigators were talking to these workers, what's your sense of the ones that tended to come up all the time and that were top priority for the workers in these factories?
I think the need to do those overtime hours, it really wears... I mean, workers are exhausted. It really wears on workers to have to do 11 hours, 11 and a half hours. Another thing is unpaid work. This is something that is obviously illegal, and it's really frustrating to workers that they have to come in 15 minutes, 30 minutes early before their shift is supposed to start and stand there and either be yelled at or just stand and, talk, but they're unpaid for this time. And then after work, after they're exhausted, they have to stand for another 15 minutes, and it's usually being criticized if they've made a mistake. And it's the entire group has to stand, even if you didn't do anything. That to workers is very unfair, and I think most people can agree that's unfair, and it's illegal.
And so what would you like to see happen now?
We would like to see Apple standardize labor practices, labor conditions across their supply chain, and we want these labor conditions to live up to Apple's own code and the law. If that were to happen, the situation would be much better.
Kevin Slayton, Program Coordinator for China Labor Watch in New York. Thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks. Appreciate the interview.
In Turkey, work continues on the country's massive Ilisu Dam project. The government says it will provide water, energy and security in the country's southeast. But opponents say the project is causing environmental damage and the destruction of a 12,000-year-old city on the banks of the Tigris River. Indigenous people from South America and Africa who are fighting dam projects in their own communities recently travelled to the region in an effort to globalise resistance to an international dam-building boom. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
Stone arches from a 12th century medieval bridge span across the Tigris River, a testament to Hassan Kaif's golden age as a major stop on the Silk Road. The evening call to prayer lilts up with muezzins from mosques on either side of the river calling and answering to each other. But if the Ilisu Dam is completed, it will destroy a community that's been continually inhabited for at least 12,000 years. That's led activists from Chile, Brazil, and Kenya to join local villagers and Turkish activists to block the entrance to the building site of the Ilisu Dam. The largest of its kind in Turkey, the dam would flood Hasan Kaif and more than 120 square miles would be submerged in a giant lake, forcing resettlement of an estimated 15,000 people. Truckers idled impatiently while protesters carried banners and chanted in Spanish, Portuguese, and Kurdish. Moira Milan, an indigenous Mapuche activist from Chile, says she's appalled that the dam would include flooding the town of Hasan Kaif.
We're defending the Tigris River from these dams that they want to build here in Hasan Kaif. And we are showing our solidarity with the people of Hasan Kaif, with the Tigris River. Because in Patagonia, Mapuche people also fight against dams. Also, we want rivers there to be free. And as people of the world, we want an end to dam construction. Enough. There are already too many dead rivers in the world. We can't continue with this madness.
Milan is joined by Umar Güzel, a 37-year-old Turkish Kurd from Hasan Kaif, who says he doesn't want to be resettled into a new complex of structures being built on higher ground.
This dam project must stop. Let the Tigris River be free. This is all we ask. We don't want anything else.
Turkey's population and economy have been growing rapidly, with the International Energy Agency projecting the country's energy needs will double in the next 10 years. This demand is one argument for the Ilisu Dam and the 1,200-megawatt hydroelectric plant. Another argument is security. Ilisu is in the southeast, the Kurdish heartland where the Turkish government has been battling the PKK militant group since the 1980s. The dam waters would flood valleys and ravines along the Tigris, effectively cutting off the PKK's overland route from major population centers and the lawless borderlands of northern Iraq. But a peace deal in April led to the withdrawal of PKK fighters into northern Iraq as part of a long-term ceasefire. Terms of the ceasefire deal remained a secret, and concrete continues to pour on the dam building site. Activists say they'd feared trying to enter the area until now because of the Turkish military presence. Activists have tried to link the dam to the peace process, and there are signs that ethnic Kurdish leaders are listening. Osman Baydemir is the mayor of Diyarbakir, the largest city with a Kurdish majority and unofficial capital of Turkish Kurdistan. He says the cessation of fighting is just a ceasefire, and the dam could block a long-term settlement.
For a greater lasting peace, I think the government has to change its policies with respect to nature when it considers its investments and its relation to nature. As long as our forests are suffering, our rivers are dying, it won't be possible to talk about a lasting peace.
There are also dam opponents outside of Turkey. Cutting off the waters of the Tigris River into Iraq creates an additional source of friction. Azam Awash, founder of the environmental group Nature Iraq, says choking off the Tigris would be disastrous for Iraqi farmers. After their work restoring marshes that had been drained by the government of Saddam Hussein, Awash says the depletion of Tigris River water will be another blow to the ecosystem and Iraq's agricultural sector.
If Ilisu Dam is finished and the reservoirs are filled, then whatever we have restored of the marshes will die, initially. Eventually, however, agriculture in Iraq, the land where it was born, is going to die.
He explains that as fresh water from the Tigris is restricted, backflows from the Persian Gulf will salinate farmland upstream in Iraq's agricultural heartland and replace cultivated land with salt marsh.
Frankly, rice and cereal cannot grow in brackish water, but reeds can. So, if we don't do anything, the first thing that's going to happen is the marshes are going to dry. Then agriculture is going to dry. Then the marshes are going to be restored again because then all you have left is brackish water.
The $1.5 billion project was first proposed in the 1980s and finally broke ground in 2006 with backing from a European consortium of credit agencies. International financing was withdrawn in 2009, following outcry over Turkey's failure to meet ecological and cultural concerns. But the following year, the Turkish government reached a lending agreement with two large Turkish banks. Güven Ekin, chair of Doha, an environmental group, says the zeal in which the government keeps pushing such an expensive project raises questions about whether officials are acting in the public interest or financial interest of politically connected construction firms.
The main motivation to build Ulusu Dam is undoubtedly development and flow of government money to a number of companies. This is evident by the fact that the dam is built with no tendering process. This is basically shifting the public money to the hands of a number of companies.
As international firms build dams across the world, activists say they're trying to link together to globalize resistance to large-scale dam building. Jason Rainey, director of the Berkeley, California-based International Rivers Organization, says that dams continue to sprout up internationally, despite lessons learned in the United States, where nearly 800 have been removed over the past two decades.
But the situation globally is very different. Here in the upper Tigris River in Turkey, we see Ulusu Dam as one of scores and scores, if not hundreds, of mega dams proposed in this region and throughout the world.
Legal challenges have been lodged against the Ulusu Dam. In January, a Turkish court ordered a halt to the project, ruling the government had illegally bypassed the environmental review process. But the government has ignored the court, and machinery continues to rumble onward. At the current pace, the dam could be completed next year, though no one knows when exactly the floodwaters would reach Hasan Kaif. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Hasan Kaif, Turkey.
In France today, the country's top administrative court overturned its government's ban on a type of genetically modified corn made by Monsanto. Last month, Monsanto announced it would not pursue any patent approvals for new GMO crops in Europe. But this one had been approved since 1998 and embroiled in legal and political battles ever since. Meanwhile, in the Philippines, a recent court order has taken that country in a different direction on GMO policy. Environmentalists and organic farmers have won a battle against a new GMO crop, eggplant. The eggplant is modified to produce a bacterium that kills insects which attack it. FSRN's Madonna Virola reports.
In a village in Mindoro Island, Rudy Cartesiano runs an agroforestry farm, which is also a learning site for organic farming. He's a staunch opponent of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, and actively supported the campaign against BT eggplant. On May 24, the Court of Appeals ordered the stop to testing of BT eggplant, genetically modified to contain a built-in quantity of Bacillus thuringiensis, a pesticide. However, scientists working on the field trials pledged to continue their experiments. Cartesiano says he has mixed feelings.
Because first, I'm happy that we have the courts with us. But unfortunately, I don't know the political will of our executive department. I am a member of the GMO Monitoring Committee of the province. The governor has organized it, but we have not done anything yet.
Oriental Mindoro is among the few provinces in the country that passed an ordinance in 2004 banning genetically modified organisms. There's also movement to expand organic farming, which led to passage of a national law in 2010, which, in part, provides funding for pesticide-free agriculture. But GMOs are still present in the country. According to agricultural scientists from the group Masipag, since 2002, the Department of Agriculture approved 8 GMO corn varieties. Additionally, dozens of GMOs were approved for importation for direct use as foods, feeds, or for processing. Farmers and environmental activists saw an opportunity when the government was considering GM eggplant. They filed a case against government and private agencies for field testing the crop, challenging its safety. The court agreed that the GMO eggplant could not be declared safe with full scientific certainty and ordered the Department of Agriculture and Department of Environment and Natural Resources to protect, preserve, rehabilitate, and restore the environment. Daniel Ocampo is a sustainable agriculture campaigner for Greenpeace Southeast Asia. He says the court upheld the constitutional rights of Filipinos to have a safe and healthy environment. However, he said the country lacks strong laws regulating the GMOs.
There is a proprietary of application for the international environmental law.
the idea of having the precautionary principle, for example. And also there is the lack of a national law that will actually encompass all the other aspects of GM releases into the environment, which include biosafety regulation, as well as, you know, undergoing environmental impact assessment prior to releasing the GMOs into the environment.
Daniel Ocampo says the flaws in government regulations have led to the importation of more than 60 GMO crops, including corn, soya, canola, alfalfa, and sugar beet. Because these crops are not labeled, many Filipinos don't know they are consuming GMO foods. Professor Chito Medina is National Coordinator of the Farmers and Agricultural Scientists Group, MASIPAG, which strongly opposes GMOs.
In fact, there was an attempt by some of our farmers to uproot the BT golden rice field testing in southern Luzon in Bicol region last year to show their exasperation with these ongoing field trials. They say that there are alternatives and there are other methods of controlling the pests in eggplants other than genetic engineering. So they say they don't need GMOs because they have alternatives.
Chito Medina says large corporations have convinced officials to grant them access to the country's agriculture sector.
In the Philippines, only one crop is genetically modified that is allowed to be produced commercially, and that is corn. Basically, in the Philippines, there are 8 varieties of BT corn which are produced commercially, and Monsanto is number one, and Pioneer is also there, and there is an increase of GMOs in the Philippines by Syngenta and Bayer.
But the introduction of biotech giants in the Philippines has not resulted in benefits for farmers, says Medina.
Last year, we conducted a nationwide study in selected places where GM corn is widely planted. In the Philippines, about 600,000 hectares have been reported by the Bureau of Plant Industry to be planted with GM corn, and the farmers' income has been reduced in many instances.
Biotech firms claim their crops are more disease-resistant and can yield a higher harvest and income. Mahaiko, a subsidiary of Monsanto, along with top scientists, claim the BT eggplant is safe. But Daniel Ocampo from Greenpeace says BT eggplants were found to cause damages to internal organs of mice, and its built-in insect resistance gene can create aggressive weeds that may destroy local agriculture and natural habitats. He has the same concerns for other GM crops.
What we want to happen right now is that all the ongoing applications for GMOs will not be processed. So in fact, there will be a moratorium on any and all future approvals, and that environmental releases of GMOs should be stopped at present, especially until that, you know, you have all the other aspects that we have always been wanting to ask the government, like a proper vetting protocol for releases, more independent research on GMOs inside the laboratory, of course, not outside. And of course, you know, the public should be involved. It's not an issue of science alone.
Back at the farm of Rudy Cartesiano, tall stalks of spiky lemongrass dot the landscape. It's what he uses as a general repellent for any crop, saying even snakes are afraid of it. Cartesiano says this is where farmers can immediately win the battle against big GMO corporations.
It's really very hard to fight Monsanto. They have that much money and we cannot afford. We cannot afford to go to the courts. We don't have that much money. The only recourse that I think is we go to the farmers. We try to attack this problem in the farm level.
Cartesiano and other campaigners say they will continue their advocacy outside the courtroom, in the streets, and in the farm fields with the goal of making the Philippines an organic country. Madonna Virola, FSRN, Mindoro Island.
And that's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Molly Stentz and Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Carla West. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Kansas City, standing in for Dorian Marina, I'm Danny Wood.